assets and imposing travel bans on 5 more Syrian political and military leaders. State-run media continues to report that Syrian forces are simply clearing roadblocks and combating armed gangs. Peter Kenyon, NPR News.
The famine in East Africa means unintentional fasting for many Muslims observing the holy month of Ramadan. Among those most severely affected are hundreds of thousands of Somalis at the Dadaab refugee camp in eastern Kenya. Most Muslims observing Ramadan do not eat after sunrise and break the fast at sunset, but at the camp, refugees say they don't have food to break the fast. Eastern Japan is the site of yet another strong earthquake, but Reuters news service says there have been no immediate reports of injuries or damage. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from MetLife Foundation, committed to promoting healthy families and good nutrition, on the web at MetLife.org.
Today's broadcast is made possible by the Friends of WILL and by The Great Impasta, a family-owned restaurant serving foods from northern Italy for more than 25 years. The Great Impasta, located in Lincoln Square in downtown Urbana. More information is available at 359-7377.
2 o'clock in the afternoon when these babies coming home from school, y'all, shoot. For real? This is unacceptable for me to be holding this boy, this young man's obituary.
Amina Matthews is a former gang member who intercedes to stop the cycle of violence in Chicago in the new documentary, The Interrupters. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with her and director Steve James. Join us.
Decisions and some stupid calls.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer. Jason Croft at the controls this hour. Kyle Mabry was on hour number one. We're sorry that we're not able to do the show that we had scheduled. We were going to talk with legal scholar Paul Finkelman about his biography of Millard Fillmore. We will do that on another day. Instead, we're going to the Focus Archives for a program we first broadcast in early May. So as you listen, keep in mind that during this hour, we'll not be taking calls. In this hour of Focus, we'll be talking about Congo and the long-running war there, something that it's very difficult to get a handle on. This was a conflict that lasted, roughly speaking, about 10 years, from 1996 until 2006. It involved 9 countries, at least 20 different rebel groups, and it's estimated that millions of people have died as a result. This is a conflict that some people have called Africa's World War, the biggest civil war in modern history. But because of its complex nature, something that outsiders have a very difficult time understanding, and many people argue that, unlike other conflict areas of Africa, that it simply hasn't gotten the level of attention that it should. In this hour of the show, we'll be trying to untangle this very tangled story as we talk with Jason Stearns about his recent book, Dancing in the Glory of Monsters. The subtitle is The Collapse of the Congo and the Great War of Africa. Public Affairs is the publisher. Jason Stearns has worked on the conflict in the Congo for the past 10 years, most recently as head of a special UN panel investigating Congolese rebel groups. He first went there in 2001 to work for a local human rights group on the border town of Bukavu, which was then right at the center of the fighting. He also worked for the UN peacekeeping operation as a senior analyst and as senior analyst for the International Crisis Group. He's talking with us this morning from Yale University, where he is working on a PhD, and we're pleased that he could be with us this morning. Well, Jason Stearns, hello.
Hi.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
It's my pleasure.
I appreciate it. I think that there are a number of consequences that follow from this being a complicated story. And maybe the big one is that so many people have looked at it and have said, this is too much for me. I can't quite take this in. I can't sort it out. And not only have individuals taken that kind of come away with that kind of understanding or lack of understanding, but governments have as well.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that this is sort of an ethical challenge for us, to the extent that on one level, in terms of fatalities and how many people have died in the conflicts, it compares very easily to the Rwandan genocide, the Cambodian genocide, even to the Jewish Holocaust. 5.4 million people And that's a conservative estimate. That's from 1998 to 2007, and the war started in 96 and violence continues now. So on one level, it's sort of on par or at least in the same league as those other conflicts. But on another level, it's a very different kind of conflict. This is not a conflict where it's easy to identify the good guys and the bad guys or even the two sides necessarily involved. As you said in your introduction, this is a conflict that has had at least 20 different warring parties. And actually today you can count up to 40 different armed groups on the ground in the East, all of whom are fighting for complex reasons. So the fact that it's kind of an ethical challenge to us that we care less about a conflict that we don't understand as well as others. We care less about a conflict whose narrative is more complex. And I think that's an interesting point to make, and I think this is something that people – it's food for thought.
Well, and I think that certainly it has been – now, if you're going to learn about this, I guess you're going to learn about it by reading it in the pages of the New York Times or some other of the world's large news organizations. It's been a real challenge for journalists as well because it doesn't fit the master narrative that can be applied to other conflicts in Africa or other places. And again, it goes back to this complicated nature of the conflict and that there's no clear sides. You can't say, well, these are the good guys over here and these are the bad guys over here. It makes it very difficult as a journalist. It makes it very difficult to try to tell this story.
Yeah, I can't tell you how many times when I was living in the Eastern Congo that journalist friends of mine would visit me and just wring their hands in despair about how to package the story. And usually the way they ended up packaging the story was by focusing on somewhat stereotypical images. So you'd have the image of the African warlord would be a favored one, or the image of a victim would be a favored one. So it became a sort of a caricature of the war, and the complexities and the real reasons behind the war didn't really shine through to the extent where people, I think the unfortunate consequence of that kind of storytelling was that people here in the United States had a feeling that it was a war over no reason whatsoever. It was just a mess, and that Africans were killing each other because they're Africans. And that's obviously not correct, and that was the main motivation behind writing this book.
Mm. Well, I think that you do a good job and that you do at least try to take it into manageable pieces. And rather than talk about the whole post-colonial history of the Congo, maybe the place we can start is to talk a little bit about Congo under the rule of Mobutu Sese Seko, and at the time that we're really talking about here, the mid-90s, what kind of condition was the country then called Zaire in after decades of rule by Mobutu?
Right. That's a good place to start. I sort of break it down into three causes in the war. One is the regional cause, which is the Rwandan genocide. Mm-hmm. One are local causes, which are between local political communities in the Eastern Congo. And then there's what you just pointed out, the national cause, the fact that after 32 years of misrule by Mobutu Sese Seko, the country's infrastructure and administration had really collapsed. And while I think the Belgian state during its colonial days had really done very little to prepare the country for being a viable state in the first place, the Mobutu had only just exacerbated sort of the erosion of the state apparatus. So, you know, there was I quote this in my book, there's a news report by The Economist on the eve of the war where they say some people call it the Congo. We just call it a Congo-shaped hole in the center of Africa because the state had broken down into competing factions within the National Army. There was very little state administration that had worked, and that really made it sort of a breeding ground for rebel groups from neighboring countries to the extent where in 1996 when the war broke out, that Congo or Zaire as it was then called hosted almost a dozen different armed groups from neighboring countries. So Mobutu had earned the wrath of all of these different neighboring countries, and that really prepared the ground for what was to come.
Mm. And maybe also it'd be worth just talking about the Cold War angle here, because perhaps the reason that Mobutu had been in power for such a long time was that as far as the West, particularly the United States, was concerned, that he was part of the anti-communist set of governmental allies that we'd assembled around the world, and so because he was standing against communism on the continent, he was our guy.
Yeah, there's a lot of truth to that. Although I must say, Mobutu was he was a very skilled diplomat. Mobutu was not a tin pot dictator of the stupid kind, I would say. He was a very, very skilled diplomat, and he did get a lot of support from the United States. You can just go on the web and Google Mobutu images, and automatically you'll have him sitting with Nixon, him sitting with Reagan, him sitting with George H.W. Bush. He was probably the favorite African ruler in the White House over many decades. I remember when Bill Clinton first traveled to the region to meet Mobutu's successor, Laurent Kabila, he had a conversation with Laurent Kabila where he said, I remember going to school and seeing Mobutu in power, and then when I arrive in the White House and people brief me and tell me he's still in power, I was wondering what the hell's going on. He's been in power for 30 years. And that really sort of – and throughout those 30 years, he was a very, very close ally of the United States. Now, however, Mobutu was an expert at manipulating his various allies. He, at various points in time, was close with China, with North Korea, always with Belgium and France. And that allowed him really to stay in power for 32 years.
Quickly, just let me introduce again our guest, Jason Stearns. And we're talking about his book, Dancing in the Glory of Monsters, The Collapse of the Congo and the Great War in Africa. It's just out by Public Affairs Books. And we're talking about the Congo War. And so here you've talked about sort of the first of these three major areas, and that is Zaire, Congo, as a weak or failed state, at least with a weak central government. Then we come to the Rwanda genocide. Now, Rwanda is right next door, so shares a border with Congo. And a thing people will remember, this happened in 1994, hundreds of thousands of people were killed in Rwanda in a conflict between the two major ethnic groups in the country, the Hutu and the Tutsi.
Yeah. 1994, as a culmination, really, of the Rwandan civil war that started in 1990, the genocide was carried out and almost a million people were brutally massacred in Rwanda. As a result of this, the rebels then in Rwanda took power, and this was predominantly from the Tutsi minority group, and they remain in power today, led by President Paul Kagame. And the former government of the Hutu-led dominated government of Habyarimana fled into exile, and about a third of the country followed them. Over a million people fled into exile into the eastern Congo, along with the people who had perpetrated the genocide. So their fleeing into exile was not really the end of the Rwandan civil war, but was sort of, you could say, sort of a temporary ceasefire in the Rwandan civil war, because the people who had executed the genocide were now in these refugee camps in the eastern Congo, being sustained in part by aid shipments from donors all over the world. And this was really the proximate cause of the ensuing war. It was unacceptable for the new Rwandan government that their arch enemies were lurking across the border, as they say, just waiting to come back to the country to finish the job they had begun in exterminating the Tutsi population. There was hate radio stations broadcasting from the refugee camps in Rwanda, saying things to that effect. And the international community was unwilling to go into these refugee camps and do what international law required, which was move them away from this international border and to demilitarize them. And as a result of this, in 1996, the Rwandan government, along with many African allies, took the initiative and said, okay, if you're not going to do this, then we will. And they invaded the eastern Congo, broke up the refugee camps, and then took the battle all the way to the capital, Kinshasa, 1,000 miles away.
Yeah. So So again, after the Rwanda genocide, a lot of Hutus, including people who were involved in the genocide, go across the border into eastern Congo, and then Hutu rebels continued to use that as a base so they could raid in back over into Rwanda. Rwandan government very unhappy about this. And at that time Mobutu was still, although near the end of his rule and weak, probably politically and also physically, was he at all sympathetic to the Hutus that were there in eastern Congo, or was it that he just didn't want to do any particular favors for the Rwandan government? What was that relationship like?
Well, it was complicated. Mobutu was a very wily political character. He saw this first and foremost as an opportunity. As many countries in Africa, he had been, after the Cold War, he lost his support. He was no longer as useful anymore for the United States in particular, and he had been forced to democratize. And he was sort of on his last legs. Also physically, he was at that point, he was suffering from cancer. Mm-hmm. And he saw the refugee crisis in the east of the country as sort of an opportunity to recover his international standing. And in a very perverse fashion, he was succeeded at this. He showed himself as, people from all over the world, diplomats from all over the world would come and curry his favor, and he was relevant again. You know, they needed Mobutu to deal with the refugees. So he played this in a very expert fashion. Then I think a second factor, very, very important, was his personal relationship with the former Rwandan president, Juvenal Habyarimana, who had been killed at the beginning of the genocide. And who is Hutu and whose government then fled into exile. Mobutu was very close to Habyarimana to the extent where Habyarimana's body that was taken out of the aircraft that was shot down at the beginning of the Rwandan genocide was evacuated to the eastern Congo, made its way to Mobutu's home palace in the jungle, 1,000 miles away. And eventually Mobutu had his body cremated. During this whole time, Habyarimana's widow, Agathe, was staying with Mobutu for much of this time. So the personal relationship between Mobutu and the Hutu government there played a large role. And then there was the fact that Mobutu saw himself as sort of now, maybe he wasn't the bulwark against communism, but in a very sort of strange way, he was a bulwark against Anglophone expansionism in Central Africa. This may sound silly to listeners here, but French foreign policy in this part of Africa was very strongly influenced by the fact that they wanted to preserve French-speaking regimes against what they saw encroaching Anglophone regimes. And the new Tutsi government of Paul Kagame, who's in power today, is an English-speaking government, whereas the former Hutu government was a French-speaking government. So all these factors played a role.
Mm-hmm. Well, so Rwanda had this set of concerns about Hutu rebels that were in eastern Congo and raiding into Rwanda. Maybe mm-hmm. they also had some issues with Mobutu. Some other governments in the region did too. So in 1996, they put together a coalition to break up these camps, eventually bring down Mobutu. And although it seemed they didn't want to make it look as if that's what they were doing. That is, they were invading Congo to get rid of Mobutu. So they backed this Congolese rebel group that had been fighting Mobutu for a long time. This was the group that was led by a man named Laurent Kabila. Tell us about him.
Laurent Kabila was sort of a relic of the Cold War as well, kind of like Mobutu in that sense. He had been fighting against Mobutu since the 1960s. Largely out of a very small area in the remote mountainous area in the eastern Congo, backed at some points by various communist-leaning or communist governments, but largely as the 1980s and 90s rolled in, largely forgotten and irrelevant. He didn't have much support locally or internationally anymore, especially after the end of the Cold War. So when, to a certain extent, when the refugee crisis began and when governments in the region, Rwanda and Uganda in the lead, decided that they needed to invade the Congo basically, they knew very well one thing, which is that international community does not like foreign invasions. And this is literally what the Ugandan president told the Rwandan president: we need to find a fig leaf to be able to cover our involvement, more or less. And that fig leaf needs to be a Congolese rebel movement. So they shopped around the region, literally, for potential leaders. And they found a couple, and then they stumbled upon Laurent Kabila, who had been fighting against Mobutu for 4 decades, was this eccentric, revolutionary, influenced by Maoist rhetoric, but somewhat dictatorial in his own management of his own rebels, had fallen into gold smuggling and ivory trading over the years. And they decided that this would be their best, the most legitimate person to lead this movement. And that's how they picked him. And in 1996, he became the head, the de facto head of this new rebellion.
So you can see it seems pretty obvious why it is perhaps that the government of Rwanda would have issues with Mobutu and would like to see somebody else running Congo. But what would have been the motivation of some of the other governments in the surrounding countries to want to be a part of that effort?
Well, some of them it was very clear as for security reasons. As I said, Mobutu had become the host of rebel groups from all over the region. There were Jonas Savimbi's UNITA rebels from Angola were there. There were Ugandan rebels. There were Burundian rebels, literally from all over the region. So that was one main reason. And all of those countries I just mentioned ganged up against Mobutu. But I think a larger reason was that this was a period of what they call African Renaissance, where rebel groups were overthrowing Cold War dictatorial regimes across Africa. New regimes had come to power, inspired by leftist ideology, but more so also just in terms of just overthrowing dictators from the past in Eritrea, in Ethiopia, in Uganda, in Rwanda. The ANC had come to power in South Africa. And this is what, as the president of South Africa, Thabo Mbeki, would say, this was what the African Renaissance was. So Mobutu, in the context of this, was seen as a dinosaur and as somebody who needed to go. So when the Rwandan government, together with the Ugandan government, formed this rebellion, this Congolese rebellion, to break up the refugee camps and overthrow Mobutu, it was a pan-African movement. It was, you had Tanzania backing it, you had Zambia sending money, you had Zimbabwe sending equipment, you had most of Africa ganging up against this guy who was seen as a relic from the past.
Well, it seems pretty clear that while Mr. Kabila, with outside help, was successful in toppling Mobutu, that Kabila didn't have the capacity to govern. One wonders, though, really, was Laurent Kabila any worse than Mobutu?
You know, I think the answer to that, it's very difficult to answer that question. Laurent Kabila came to power with this Pan-Africanist movement, you could say, in May 1997. And by August 1998, the country was at war again. And the country he took over in May 1997 was a complete wreck, a complete disaster. I mean, I describe in the book how they went to the central bank and they find a 20 French franc note in the central bank, and that was it. There was no money in the bank. The country was unable to get much foreign aid because of a controversy over the massacres against refugees that had been carried out by the coalition that Kabila was at the head of. So they didn't have any foreign aid. So it was very difficult. I mean, even if you had the most visionary, competent leader in the world, it would have been very difficult. Now, Kabila was not the most competent. He was a visionary leader. He had a vision for the country. It was a very bizarre vision for the country. He was, like I said, sort of Rip Van Winkle, who had stumbled out of a time warp and then from the 1960s, who had was speaking more the language of state-run socialism than of anything that could have gotten his country back on its feet again. But we have to also acknowledge that the country was faced by enormous challenges. And then by August 1998, he was at war again, and then he didn't have time to worry about rebuilding the country, and he was focused 100% on trying to defeat his new enemies, who were his allies of yesterday, yeah, Namely Rwanda and Uganda.
Well, that brings us to the question of his falling out with his former allies. As you say, we're in a way, you can look at this as being two wars. The first war was the war that was fought to topple Mobutu and put Mr. Kabila into power, but it was about a year or something before he ended up falling out with his former allies. And then we have a second war with Rwanda attempting then to topple Mr. Kabila. Why did he fall out with the Rwandans?
I mean, the seeds for that, I think, were really sown at the very beginning of the war against Mobutu. The fact that, I mean, the story I told you about Uganda and Rwanda shopping around the region for a Congolese rebel, and the fact that the whole time he wasn't necessarily a puppet, but he certainly didn't have – he wasn't the fighting force. He didn't provide the military backbone of the movement that overthrew Mobutu. So he arrived in Kinshasa not only with immense challenges in terms of rebuilding the country, an almost impossible situation to deal with, but also in terms of his own military coalition as a very, very weak figure. And he was a paranoid person to begin with. And he immediately saw the writing on the wall. They could get rid of him at any point in time. I describe in my book how his personal bodyguards were Rwandan. The guy who carried his pen and notebook was a Rwandan. The guy who stood outside the door at night when he was sleeping was a Rwandan. And so he was extremely paranoid that they would just one day decide that this old Maoist rebel from the past was not good for us and let's get rid of him. And actually, there are some indications that Rwanda was thinking along those lines and that there may have been attempts to get rid of Kabila even after 6 or 9 months of being in power. So I think that really provided the sort of seeds of this new feud between Rwanda and the Congo. We also have to, I think, throughout the book, really, one of the themes is Rwanda's hubris in terms of dealing with the Congo. They've been very controlling. At the beginning, they wanted to overthrow Mobutu. They thought they could then control whoever came next. And when that person ended up being relatively independent and speaking out against them, then they wanted to get rid of him. And I think that it's this lack of political nuance, in particular during this period, that set Rwanda as well on a very militarist path and a very aggressive attitude towards the Congo.
Well, I have some callers here I want to get to in a moment. Maybe just let me take this one step further. And we talked about the fact that now here Rwanda attempts to topple Kabila, which would have happened if other governments in the region had not come to Mr. Kabila's aid. Maybe we can talk about that. But I just, because you were talking about indications that maybe early on, after Laurent Kabila comes to power, there are people who are thinking, well, maybe we should get rid of this guy. In fact, in 2001, he was assassinated by one of his bodyguards. Nobody really knows who ultimately was responsible. I mean, they know who pulled the trigger, but who was behind that, nobody knows. What do you think are some of the leading theories for who ultimately was responsible for the assassination of Laurent Kabila?
I very quickly learned in the Congo that whenever you meet somebody, a diplomat or a political analyst, who says that he knows 100% with 100% certainty that something is taking place, and you should always mistrust them. And I think this applies to Kabila's assassination as well. In my book, even, I don't say that I know 100% certainty who killed him. I lay forward a bunch of different hypotheses and then highlight the sheer amount of rumors and conspiracies that are swirling around this event. I think that obviously we know he was assassinated by his bodyguard, Rashidi Kasereka. And that his bodyguards around him had good reason to kill him just on their own. I mean, they'd been mistreated, they felt, by him. They'd fought for him. Many of these bodyguards, who were young Congolese from the eastern Congo, had given their lives for him. And there was internal bickering in his inner circle over various different managerial issues. And that could have been a motivation. However, if you trace back the financial links that these people had, you soon find that there was a group of people who was perhaps closer to masterminding this, sort of the puppeteers, if you want to call them that, who were able to flee right after this event. And they fled to Rwanda. And there's also indications from Rwanda that there were people at this point who were trying to orchestrate the assassination of Kabila. So that would, you know, point in the direction of this being orchestrated by Rwanda. The big question mark then is that if that was the case, why didn't Rwanda take advantage of assassination to take the war to Kinshasa or even to push an offensive along the front line? Instead, there was complete radio silence after his assassination along the front line, no military action. So there's a lot of uncertainty around his death, and I go into great detail. There was even the favorite conspiracy in Kinshasa is that on the body of the bodyguard who assassinated him, they found the business card of the defense attaché from the United States. Now, of course, this doesn't – a business card on a soldier does not – is not conclusive proof that the United States was behind anything. But this, of course, has fueled an enormous amount of conspiracy in Kinshasa.
In this hour, the guest is Jason Stearns. He's worked on the conflict in the Congo for the past 10 years, most recently as head of a special UN panel investigating Congolese rebel groups. He first went there in 2001 to work for a local human rights group in the border town of Bukavu, which was then right at the center of the war. He also later worked for the UN peacekeeping operation and as a senior analyst for the International Crisis Group. And he is the author of a recently published book. The title is Dancing in the Glory of Monsters, The Collapse of the Congo and the Great War of Africa, and is published by Public Affairs. And just maybe real quick, I would have you explain that the title were words spoken by Laurent Kabila to people who were celebrating the toppling of Mobutu.
Yeah, it was very important for me writing this book to make clear that or try to disabuse people of the notion that the reason behind the war in Africa or the war in the Congo, rather, is because of a bunch of savage warlords who are fighting over resources. And this idea that you can personalize the evil, that it's the fault of Mobutu or that it's the fault of Kagame or it's the fault of some warlord or the other. And rather to focus on the political system and the history of the political system that goes back centuries and goes back to the Belgian colonialism and even slave trade before that. And it was very much the sentiment that Laurent Kabila was expressing when he was met by this crowd that was, you know, screaming, "Down with Mobutu, down with Mobutu." And he addressed them, and instead of, you know, congratulating them for that, he started haranguing them and said, you know, "You who are screaming down with Mobutu, you guys were all complicit in this system. You were all taking bribes. I didn't see any of you protesting in the streets against Mobutu. I saw all of you dancing in the glory of the monster." So sort of to say that let's not focus on the man, let's focus on the political system. Now, of course, Laurent Kabila became a monster of his own to a certain extent, and with many people dancing to his tune. But I think that he was right in expressing that sentiment.
All right. Let's talk with some callers here. We'll start with somebody in Champaign, and this is line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
To begin, I'd like to applaud your, like, your willingness to engage with real complex issues in terms of how to present a story. And your initial remarks, you mentioned how it's difficult to be clear enough to maintain a narrative that the people you're speaking to, like the people that are alive to the media, can follow it. And then the difficulty, attendant difficulty we've just been talking about, to attribute evil and guilt to one party in a way that is meaningful. And like that, and that my second, this sort of plays in my second part of the question, is meaningful in a way that you tell the story and then you wish the different populations, say the U.S. population, to feel strongly enough about it, outraged enough about some particular story, that they will try to exert influence on their representatives to do something instrumental at the government level. I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but maybe you can address those concepts that I sort of threw out there, and I'll just hang up and listen to you. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Yeah, I think that summarizes my own argument pretty well. I would point out that this tension that I'm talking about in terms of complexity and trying to simplify it and bringing home to readers, to readers and listeners rather, is really well represented by the current debate around the Congo. Now, I don't really talk about this in detail in my book. My book deals with the war that lasts between 96 and 2006, but violence continues today, and it's kind of strange for somebody like me who covered the height of the war, who was involved in there throughout, to see that then you really couldn't get anybody in the United States to listen. We'd go to Congress and to the Capitol and try to figure, you know, get anybody to listen and to do something more responsibly about the Congo, and you couldn't get anybody to listen. But now, over the last, I would say, 4 years, since about 2007, increasingly there's a grassroots movement that's been built in the United States, led by activists and campaigners, and focused principally around two issues. The first issue is sexual violence. There are statistics that are about to come out that indicate that over 400,000 women a year are possibly being raped in the Congo, which is sexual violence on a scale seen nowhere else in the world. And the second issue being conflict minerals, namely the fact that the violence in the Eastern Congo is linked to a minerals trade that supplies electronics industries in the United States. And it's strange for somebody like me. I mean, it's very heartening, and I'm involved in both of these issues. On the other hand, it ends up simplifying and reducing the conflict to two issues without looking at these larger complexities. So I think it's actually great that grassroots campaigners have been able to do this. At the same time, it's very important that simplistic understanding of a conflict doesn't lead to simplistic policies going forward. And I think that's the real challenge for policymakers when they're dealing with a complex issue such as conflict minerals and minerals in the supply chain and how to regulate this, that we do so in an intelligent fashion. And that means really taking the conflict on its own terms and not trying to apply simplistic notions to a complex issue.
All right. Let's go to Effingham for another caller here on our line 4. Hello.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. I hopefully can ask your guest to the focus on the Congo is a symptom of everything else that's going on in this world, perpetrated by the United States and Western Europe, and which has gone on for all this time, and then to focus on a huge continent, and then what's happening in North Africa now, and then the root causes of all the things that your guest has talked about. I mean, it jumps out at me to think that there's not more responsibility placed on the West and how they beat these people down, took everything they could from them, and like you just said, of slavery and minerals and all the other things that continue to go on, even if the things in North Africa evolved to where they began to form a capitalist system, is it going to be any better for those at the bottom? Thank you.
Yeah, I think that... hello.
Go ahead. Yeah. The caller hung up, but I think he. Yes, we're here. I think he.
I thought you hung up.
Okay. No, sir. No. We're here.
What your caller is pointing out, it's a very interesting traveling to the Congo. I first traveled to the Congo in 2001, a week after the World Trade Center fell, and I remember arriving in a war zone in the Eastern Congo where you had something along the equivalent of a trade center falling every 3 days. In other words, 3,000 people were dying. 1,000 people were dying a day. Every 3 days, you have the equivalent in terms of death toll as the World Trade Center. And I got to the Eastern Congo, and the first thing people would do is they came and they hugged me, and they say, "We're so sorry for what happened to your country." And my reaction was, you're sorry? I mean, nobody really cares about what's going on in the Congo, and here you are, and the only thing we would do for weeks is talk about Osama bin Laden and the World Trade Center and how terrible this had been for the United States. And as much as most Americans could probably not find the Congo on a map, the Congolese are obsessed with the United States. And not only in terms of compassion for what happened in the World Trade Center, but also they think the United States plays a huge role in terms of determining their own history and the conflict. They tell, at one point in the book, I say that they're convinced that President Obama wakes up and gets a Congo briefing every morning with his morning scone. Now, this is obviously not true, but this is the degree to which they think the United States drives things. And the reason for this is not just conspiracy and the fact the U.S. is a powerful player in the world, but it's the fact that the United States for centuries has been a big player in the Congo. Many of the slaves that came from the Congo Basin came to the United States or to our hemisphere. The United States was the first country to recognize the Congo Free State, which was the private fiefdom of the Belgian King Leopold II, and that then ran a brutal, brutal system of exploitation of native Congolese for rubber, rubber which was then used in Firestone and other companies in the United States. Mobutu was supported for many years by the United States, and even today, whereas the United States was not the instigator of the war, the United States, during the war, looked the other way and didn't get involved, I think, to the degree that it should have, given its past history in the region. So I think your caller was putting his finger on something that, you know, for us, maybe the Congo is nothing. Most people don't know anything about it. But go to the Congo and say you're from the United States, and automatically they will think that you know everything about the Congo and that indeed you have a responsibility towards the Congo.
Yeah. I want to come to you. We talked in the first part of the conversation that one way to try to get a handle on this story is to maybe break it into these three big pieces and talk about Congo, Zaire under Mobutu, talk about the connection with the Rwandan genocide, and which also connects with the various kinds of concerns that neighboring countries have about both security and economic issues. And certainly you have to acknowledge the role that the Cold War played in perhaps setting up what happened and the interest of the First World in strategic resources and so forth. But it seems that your third point here, which I want to make sure that we make, is that the conditions in the country, general lawlessness, absence of a strong central government, really meant that whatever local conflicts and rivalries existed, and there were a lot of them, particularly in the East, they could play out. So, you know, it seems that there is a way in which there was a regional war, a local war going on, in addition to perhaps there being a national one.
Yeah, there were wars within wars, which is the title of one of the chapters in the book. And it's really like peeling back the different layers of an onion when you get down on the ground. I remember going into the field for one of my many trips to research the book. And, you know, just when you thought that you'd sort of understood what was happening on the local level, there'd be another conflict you discover and then another conflict. And to a certain degree, that was because of the fact that you had a vacuum of state power that allowed power to be managed at a very, very local level. And so instead of having an army that controlled everything, it was very quickly you had competing militias at the local level that became very, very important. But to a certain extent, this was even used by Mobutu in his last days to stay in power. He famously said, "After me, the deluge." In other words, if you topple me, I will make sure that whatever comes after me will be much worse than what you had under me. And he pitted ethnic communities against each other, particularly in the Eastern Congo. So that when he left and during the war, when the war began, this regional war, this national war, just really fed through oil on the fire that existed between these local communities who had been pitted against each other for many decades.
Yeah. Well, you explained, I think, did a good job of explaining that there was this effort led by Rwanda, but involving also some of the neighbors, to get rid of Mobutu, and they did that by backing this rebel group that was led by this man named Laurent Kabila. That very shortly thereafter, after Mr. Kabila came to power, there was this falling out, particularly between him and the Rwandans, and then there was an effort, Rwanda, Uganda were involved in an effort then to get rid of Kabila, and then some other nations sort of came to his assistance, and then in 2001, Kabila was assassinated. His son, a man named Joseph Kabila, took over from his father and now has been the leader of the country since. What sort of leader has Joseph Kabila been?
Joseph was, in many ways, the diametric opposite of his father. His father had been bombastic, had been a strong leader, a very eloquent leader as well. He was a great orator. He gave these great speeches on national television and radio. And Joseph was, you know, 29 years old. He was an introvert. He was shy. He barely spoke the languages of the Congo. He'd been raised outside of the Congo because his father had been a rebel. So when he came to power, he spoke better English than French. And it wasn't just in terms of his personality, but also in terms of his policies. His father had insisted on taking the war to the enemies, on a very aggressive policy, very antagonistic towards donors. Joseph came in, and he was a visionary to a certain extent. He opened up the country to international peacekeepers. He started peace talks with the enemy. He liberalized the economy. He signed deals with the World Bank, invited donors back in. So his initial period, the initial period of his tenure was, I would say, relatively positive. He was then elected at the end of the peace process that he sort of chaperoned. On the ticket of having brought peace to the Congo. His election slogan was, "The bearer of eggs does not fight." And there was this image of him bearing eggs, and the eggs were basically the peace process. And he was not going to be able to fight because he was holding together this fragile peace process. So if he went to war again, then he, you know, dropped the eggs, and that's not what he wanted to do. Now, unfortunately, since he was elected in 2006, violence has escalated dramatically in the east of the country to levels not even seen at the height of the war. And his government has also been had a relatively mediocre performance on issues of governance and tolerance of political opposition. So his opponents have accused him somewhat, I think, humorously of the saying that the bearer of eggs has made one big omelet. And that sort of, I think, epitomizes a lot of what critics accuse him of. And there are elections, incidentally, later this year, scheduled for the end of November, and there his record will really be put to the test.
Well, that was going to be my next question. Indeed, there will be presidential elections in November. I'm sure that there would have been a point where he would have been favored. I mean, perhaps he still is. Or maybe not. I mean, maybe now some people really are thinking that someone who once would have seemed to have a lock on it indeed now could well lose.
Yeah, it's going to be very contentious. And I think that the international community that is still underwriting his government to the tune of 50% of his budget, we still have 20,000 peacekeeping troops in the Congo, that we haven't really paid enough attention to the fact that elections are coming up. And they're going to be contentious. You know, in 2006, the elections were, you know, there were some flaws in the elections, but largely speaking, I think Kabila knew that he was going to win free and fair elections, and he did. He won. The elections this year, his victory is far from certain, and he knows this. In many parts of the country, in particular the East, which is what really carried the elections for him, he's become very unpopular, in a large part because of the extreme violence that that part of the country has seen over the last 5 years. Therefore, he, because he sees the writing on the wall, he may not get reelected. He will probably try to manipulate the elections in his favor, and that could be dangerous. And already we've seen some repression, some assassinations, and many people, I think, are worried of what might happen.
Mm. On to, let's see, we have another caller here in Champaign County, where we are here, line number one. Hello.
Hi. You diminish the idea of this sort of vulgar resource war with warlords, but you really haven't said much about the machinations of the Great Lakes states and great powers as well in supporting these various forces, Interahamwe and all this other stuff that's going on. So I wish I had called earlier to let you have more time to discuss it, because that is one of the complexities of the situation. But I just, it's not a simple resource war, but nothing is simple. And I think the resources and the machinations between players local and far away really need to be addressed. And maybe you'll do that in your talk. I don't know what you can do in these few minutes to address my concerns, but thanks.
Well, we certainly have at least a couple of 2-3 minutes left, so go ahead and deal with that.
I'm not sure how you can address any of these complex issues in an hour. I take your caller's point. I didn't mean to say that resources play an extremely important issue in all of this. Where the war initially began in 1996 as a war over politics and power, and natural resources did not play a huge role at the beginning of the war. They very soon came to play an enabling role in the war. The Rwandan president even said at one point that the war was self-financing for him. They were making hundreds of millions of dollars off direct exploitation of natural resources, in particular stuff that's used by the electronics industry, tin, tungsten, tantalum. And that many of these resources end up in the hands of companies based in the West and the United States. So it is incredibly important. However, this is not a case where powers in Europe or the United States are actively backing the belligerent sides in order to get access to the resources. In fact, I think many companies would feel that they want to invest in the region and they can't because it's just too chaotic, and you'd be crazy if you're an investor to sink $1 billion into mining in that region. So there's no industrial mining going on in the Eastern Congo at all. It's all artisanal, which is, doesn't make sense in terms of economies of scale. But I strongly support your caller's opinion that resources are very important. This is why I also think that the bill passed last year by U.S. Congress that has really taken a lead in this issue of resource control and due diligence, a bill passed within the Dodd-Frank Financial Regulation Act of last July, calling on all companies based in the United States to conduct due diligence on their supply chain and to make sure that they don't use or to tell their users, the consumers, whether they're using conflict minerals or not in the supply chain. And I think that that's an extremely important step in trying to bring an end to the war. But we should also recognize that even if we can regulate conflict minerals, because that was not the beginning of the war, that's not going to bring an end to the war. And these other issues as well, these geopolitical regional issues, as well as in particular the construction of a stronger, more accountable state apparatus in the Congo are also extremely important.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, we have about a minute. What could the West do to further that aim?
Well, you know, we already spend $1 billion on the Congo a year, and the really sort of the paradox of U.S. policy towards the Congo is that we have enormous amount of financial resources we pour into this region, but we don't put any political – we have very few political resources we put in. So our reaction to conflict in this region has consistently been to throw money at it, but not really to engage politically at the level that we should. So I think that we just – the first step would just be greater political engagement. There's a great push to appoint a special envoy to the Congo that I think is very important, and that there should be greater conditionality upon this aid. We can't just throw aid at a government that is not doing much to advance accountability, and it's the greatest abuser of its own citizens is the government. Hmm.
Well, we will have to stop there. If you would like to read more about Congo, look for the book that we have mentioned. The title is Dancing in the Glory of Monsters, The Collapse of the Congo and the Great War of Africa. Public Affairs Books is publisher by our guest, Jason Stearns. He's talking to us from a studio at Yale where he is completing his PhD. And we want to thank you very much, Mr. Stearns, for being our guest.
It's been my great pleasure.
And also thanks to the technical director there on the Yale end, Phil Kearney. You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. This is a show we first broadcast on May 2nd. All of our past programs are there, available for you anytime that you like. If you'd like to go back and listen to some that you might have missed first time around, just go to our website, which is WILL.illinois.edu. And the program that we had scheduled for this hour, a conversation with legal scholar Paul Finkelman talking about Millard Fillmore, probably one of the less well-known American presidents, but somebody who was a president at a great time of crisis for the country. And we'll see if we can get that scheduled for you for another day. Tomorrow morning, we will talk in the 10 o'clock hour with Christian Peretti. He's the author of a book titled Tropic of Chaos. It surveys conditions in a number of post-colonial states along the planet's mid-latitudes. These are places that are really suffering and have suffered the brunt of rough weather. He says if you scratch the surface of many contemporary conflicts, you will find a climate angle. That's hour number one. And then in the second hour, we'll talk about Machu Picchu, one of the most famous archaeological sites around the country. It was discovered, we'll put that in quotes, it was discovered by an American explorer named Hiram Bingham. In fact, that happened 100 years ago last month. In recent years, he's been denounced as both a liar and a thief, and we'll be talking with writer Mark Adams, somebody who does adventure writing, but would be the first to admit that he was not an adventurer himself. He was interested in discovering the truth about Bingham, and he decided to do it by retracing the explorer's steps. So on the program tomorrow, Mark Adams will tell us the story of his trek through the Andes in search of the truth behind the legend of the Lost City. It's all in his book, and it's titled Turn Right at Machu Picchu. That's tomorrow. We're here weekday mornings 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics every week. Right now, I think we'll get ready to hand things over to Celeste Gwynn. She's the host of the Afternoon Magazine. She'll be with you now for the rest of the afternoon.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Subaru of Champaign County, now on Route 45 in Savoy. At Subaru's assembly plant in Lafayette, Indiana, a zero landfill status is designed to save cost and our future. It's part of what makes a Subaru. Information online at SubaruofChampaign.com or 352-4700.
This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD3 Urbana, online at will.illinois.edu. 1 minute before noon, let's take a look at commodity prices. In Kansas City, the September wheat contract is off one at $7.66. The December contract down 0.75 cents at $7.92 1/4. September wheat in Chicago, $6.73 3/4, up 1 1/4. December, $7.15, down 3/4. September corn, $6.77 1/2, up 12. December, $6.81 1/4, up 12 1/2. March, $6.93 1/2, up 12. May, $7 even, up 12 1/2. August soybeans, $13.59 1/2, up 5 1/4. September, $13.55 3/4, up 7 1/4. November, $13.64 1/4, up 7. January, $13.75 1/2, up 7 1/4. August soybean meal, $3.53 even, up 1.40. August oil, $56.18, that's up 53. August live cattle, $112.87 1/2, up 25. The October contract, $117.85, up 52 1/2. August feeder cattle, $136.95, down 10. September, $138.70, up 7 1/2. August lean hogs, $102.70, down 7 1/2. Outside markets, September crude, $94.48, that is down 122.